Welcome to the latest episode of the Rebel Radio Podcast. Apologize in advance for my bit raspy voice, but you know, the pollen count is very high in Texas, and golly, it's playing with my allergies. But you know, I will venture through it. It's not as bad as, remember that time where I had like that 6 month period where I had some sort of laryngitis? You remember that?
Yeah.
And I sounded like I was talking through a fucking cigarette machine for 6 months. I still am not sure what happened during all that. That was weird, man. It was like, and then I went online and read that you can have like a bout with like long laryngitis and not even know it. And maybe that's what I had. Because laryngitis doesn't always mean you lose your voice. Sometimes you can just have laryngitis where you sounded like I did. You
know? Yeah.
So maybe I did back then.
You know? Different forms.
And, but man, it's been a short week. You know, we just recorded Saturday night and here we are Thursday. And that's just the way it is sometimes our schedules. And, but I was like, thinking like, sometimes it feels like we just did this, but that's okay, man. We're on episode 393 today, man. We're seven away from 400. 10th anniversary show coming up soon. And, It's good times as we keep rolling. And in case we did not introduce ourselves, of course, this is Mark. And
this is Matt.
Across from me is Mateo, the Matt. And thank you to Long for coming on episode last week. He's
that was fun.
He's still our unofficial third host when he shows up. You know.
Oh, yeah. You can always count on him on a Godzilla film. That's for sure.
Well, yeah. And help us kick off Monsters Month. Why didn't I just call it Monster Mania? That's what I should have called it. Are we allowed to do that in the middle of, it's only the second week of four episodes. I think we can change it to Monster Mania.
It's almost like one of those old school announcements. Monsters.
Yeah. If we change it to Monster Mania, I don't think anyone's going to fault us. You know, our whole 50 listeners a week. Someone's going to point out like, you motherfuckers, you can't do that. You know, it's like, you can't change what you call your show. We're not, well, the theme month, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know what? Fuck you, man. We can do what we want because it's our podcast.
That's right. We can call it whatever we want.
Yeah.
We can call it potatoes if we want to.
Damn right.
Yeah. Potatoes.
But no, we've made it this long as the Rebel Radio Podcast. We almost did a name change at one point whenever we rebooted the show. We talked about it. And
mm-hmm.
Or I talked about it in my head. I don't remember if I mentioned it to you, but we stuck with the
Testicular Sound Express. We thought about it.
Well, actually, no, it really, I'll be honest. This is a little reveal before our 10th anniversary. I really was close to calling it Pop Goes the Culture.
Wow.
Like a play on Pop Goes the Weasel. And because we do a pop culture and stuff like that. And then, and I played with that title. I was even like, Pop Goes to the Movies. That was another one.
Yeah.
And I kept sticking the word pop in there. And then I was like, I kept thinking, man, that sounds too teeny boppish. You know, we're kind of grown men, you know? So those were a couple ideas I honestly did play with. You know, it was pop this and pop that. And then I thought about doing something simple like the Rebel Radio Movie Podcast. Oh, that was genius. Just adding the word movie in there.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's stupid. You know? So we stuck with the Rebel Radio Podcast. So a little reveal there as we trek forward. And of course, the Rebel Radio Podcast.com is where you can find all our episodes. And as we move closer and go back and enjoy our back catalog sometimes. There's a lot of good films we've covered over the last several years. And we will continue to do so.
Yeah, cover some of the best ones, some of the ones you've never heard about, some of the ones that are small successes, niche films, you know, you name it. We've covered it.
And we still have movies that are deep cuts that we haven't even touched. Like we haven't touched Rad yet, you know, which is definitely a kind of a deep cut.
And that's coming out on Fathom Events. It should be a Fathom event showing.
It was already in March. It happened in March.
Oh, yeah. No.
Yeah. You know, and things like that. So, you know, there's things we haven't done. We haven't done G.I. Joe, the movie, the animated one. You know, we've done Transformers. There's things like that. There, Fire and Ice, which is a Ralph Bashke cult classic animated film. You know, there's a lot of things we haven't done, and but we will get to those. And other than that, man, because it's been such a short week, I haven't watched shit. I'll be honest. I mean,
you didn't watch 97 X-Men 97?
No, I haven't had time, man. I kind of forgot yesterday was Wednesday and just didn't get around to watching it. And then today, you know, we had baseball practice. So, you know, so yeah, man, I've fallen behind on Shogun. I just, I've not done well, but I've played a lot of Spider-Man 2 on the PlayStation 5.
Oh, okay.
Which is really cool. So I have played games, you know, and it's, you know, it's like in an alternate Spider-Man universe. Like the basics are the same, you know, Peter and Mary, MJ and Harry Osborn, but like there's no Green Goblin in it. Like, you know, Harry Norman doesn't become Green Goblin, but the Venom thing is used as a cure at the end of Spider-Man 1 to try to cure Harry. And then part 2, Harry finds he has Venom inside him before it transfers over to Peter. And then I haven't gotten this far in the game, but I know that Harry becomes Venom. So it's kind of a different story, you know.
Okay.
They do some alternate takes and say Eddie Brock, but yet it's one of those alternate takes where you forgive it because it's so well done. I mean, it's some really great video game storytelling. It feels like playing a movie or a live action comic book throughout it. And so, you know, I've been enjoying that, and it looks crisp and clean and badass on the PS5, man. The power of the PS5, the way it runs games and its high performance mode is pretty incredible with the frame rates. You know, I broke down and bought a PS5 just a couple weeks ago, and so far, no regrets, you know, spending that money. Got a little bonus check at work, so I was like, you know what? I'm going to buy a PS5.
There you go, man.
I splurge. I always, you know, I do those things. I'm like, oh, man, I hope something doesn't go wrong, you know. But I'm like, you know, you got to make life a little bit, you know.
Yeah, man. You got to have some fun.
Yeah. Otherwise, you just stare at the wall and count to five.
For real.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like that's all I've really watched or done this week was play some Spider-Man, and you know, I've tried to watch. I just didn't have time to watch anything. You know, we recorded Saturday, Sunday was busy, Monday we had a baseball game, then Tuesday, Wednesday, I think I spent time playing Spider-Man was what it was. I just haven't had time to play, but it's okay. You know, and then to be fair, our X-Men 97, the Bad Batch, there's not a whole lot new out right now. I mean, we're kind of in that stalemate again with new stuff on streaming, you know, and then things will start hitting. I mean, we got Rebel Moon Part 2 here in a couple of weeks, and, you know, so hopefully some stuff will start hitting streaming soon to watch.
Yeah, man. I actually forgot that I watched, I don't think I talked about it on the show, and I think I mistook talking about it on the show when I talked about it with you and Long, and that's Roadhouse. I never talked about Roadhouse on the show, did I?
Yeah,
you did. The new one? I did?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Maybe, for some reason, I thought I forgot. Maybe I was just really quick about it. But another movie that I checked out this week. Crap.
It was that good, huh?
Now it's throwing me off.
It was that fascinating.
It was that fascinating. Yeah. I'll start off with streaming. I did watch Invincible, the newest episode, and I like where it's going. I say that every time, but I feel like it's just as good as X-Men 97 is about leaving cliffhangers at the end of the film. It's very entertaining. It's bloody. It's multidimensional. They threw it in there, but it's tasteful. It's tastefully done. It doesn't feel like they're trying to copy Marvel or DC or anything like that. It's definitely its own thing. And it is based on a comic series with the same name. So if you haven't checked it out, and while it's in season 2, get rolling on it for sure. X-Men 97. It's been awesome. It's episode 4 is good.
I have heard it's kind of the weakest so far.
Yeah,
I've heard it's still good.
Yeah, it's definitely different. It features heavily on Jubilee and Storm as she is trying to deal with life after losing her powers. She links up with Forge, as you see at the end of episode 3, and he's trying to help her. Possibly get her powers back, and you'll have to see how that goes. in episode 4, if you haven't checked it out yet. Yeah, I'm really trying to think what I saw, because I saw something and I can't remember what I actually watched that was of 2024. It's killing me. I guess I'll have to think of it later, but I think whenever I thought, we watched Ricky Stenicki on Prime. So I had seen it and the trailer.
I'm probably going to be afraid I asked. I haven't.
Yeah, it's a comedy starring John Cena as the lead, Zac Efron, I recognize one of the other guys. He's on a podcast a lot, telling inappropriate jokes, and I don't know his name. But those are the two biggest people on there, and basically, John Cena plays this guy who's down on his luck. He's performing in Atlantic City he basically takes a bunch of songs and makes them into jack off songs and performs them in front of people. And like he does Whip It.
I'm afraid I asked.
Yeah, he does. He dresses up as all these characters. Like he dresses up as Peter Frampton. And instead of Baby, I Love Your Way, it's Baby, I Masturbate. He dresses up as Billy Idol. And instead of It's a Nice Day for a White Wedding, it's a nice day for some wood whacking. And it's actually pretty funny. He dresses up as Britney Spears at one point. He's a trained actor. He tells everyone he's a trained actor. Zac Efron and his friends run into him in Atlantic City. They basically create this facade of Ricky Stenicki. He's a fake person, but they create him to like blame stuff on. And it kind of goes through.
It's directed by Peter Farrelly. That explains a lot.
Dumb and Dumber, Me, Myself, and Irene, Something About Mary. So it's very much a 2000s raunchy comedy. I will say that the movie and they basically hire John Cena to play this guy that they made up, because now they've come in an impasse where people are asking who this person really is, and they've made him up since childhood. So they basically bring him in, and he is now immersed in their lives, and all kind of disarray occurs after that. I won't get into it, but I will say it's a enjoyable comedy. I won't say that there's a certain part that really sticks out and says, man, this part's really, really funny. I feel like it's enjoyable throughout. But you know, if I'm looking at Peter Farrelly's other films, Dumb and Dumber, way more memorable. Something About Mary, it had some good parts. I would probably say it's closer to Something About Mary than it is any other of his films. I think Dumb and Dumber and Me, Myself, and Irene are his best ones. Something About Mary is okay. It's an okay. It was good at the time. It's a classic. Frank and Beans, Ben Stiller getting his junk caught in his zipper. But then after that, it kind of, it's okay. And this is kind of in the same vein. You've got funny moments throughout, but none of them are like really funny. Except whenever he's performing and karaokeing, dubbing.
Sounds like a pass.
All those jack-off songs. That's probably the funniest part.
I mean, this whole thing sounds like a Matt movie completely.
It's a Matt movie. It's definitely a Matt movie. You would definitely watch this and say,
and our buddy Frank, he would understand. Probably watch it.
Oh, yeah. Frank would probably think it was more enjoyable than me. He would probably sell you way harder on it.
I mean, Frank's almost 50 years old and he lasted a fart. So, I mean,
this is true. I'll give it a C. I'll give it a C. That's probably a fair rating.
Did you know that Sony put out a Spider-Man, Spider-Verse short last week, kind of unannounced? It's little short with Miles and having a talk with his dad, and it's kind of cool. And so I wonder if press is going to start up soon for Beyond the Spider-Verse. You know, I know the voice recording process just started. So if that's the case, that means maybe we'll finally get a release date. I'm still hopeful for a 2024 release, like Christmas time.
That would be nice. We're supposed to already have it.
Yeah, I know. It was supposed to be out 2 weeks ago, but it got delayed. And did you see that trailer that came out today for Tales of the Empire? It's going to be Star Wars anthology. That looks pretty cool.
That looks cool. I'm looking forward to that.
I really liked the Tales of the Jedi stuff. I thought it was pretty neat. And that this was in that same vein.
Seeing Dooku whenever he was younger. Looks like you're going to see some droid wars. So that's going to be fun.
Yeah, it comes out May the 4th. Surprise,
perfect. Surprise, surprise. And 1 month from today.
And then we got the announcement that Julia Garner is going to be the Silver Surfer, and they're saying a version of the Silver Surfer. I guess that's their way of saying, yes, we cast a female, but don't freak out. It's a version of the Silver Surfer.
So the Silver Surfer in the comics leaves Al Shabid, the character that she is playing. He has to leave her to serve Thanos. And so in this one, they're going to make the girl who is left behind the Silver Surfer instead of the Silver Surfer. And now the Silver Surfer is going to be the man left behind, I guess. I'm assuming that. But yeah, it makes total sense. Yeah. You know, like if you just took Captain America and you're just like, oh no, we're just going to make him a regular guy. Steve Rogers is going to be a regular guy. And, you know, and then we're just going to make, you know, Agent Carter, Captain America.
Right.
Yeah.
And I didn't even realize they had cast a heavy metal dude from Stranger Things as Human Torch.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a good casting.
Is it?
I think it could work. It's got to be better than Chris Evans as, even though it was, you know, they probably asked Chris Evans to be Goofy, and he sold it on that part, and he was likable. Not the best version of the Torch, but I think if he's a little bit more serious, but still has that cockiness that the Human Torch
brings. To me, it all comes down to experience, though.
Yeah,
he was in Stranger Things, which was cool, and he hit with it, and he was in. But he hasn't, and I know he was in an episode apparently Game of Thrones, but he hasn't been in a lot. So
yeah,
I guess you're requiring Pedro Pascal and Vanessa Kirby to obviously carry the film because they have a lot of experience and they're really good actors. So I guess that's what they're looking at, you know, to go with a young actor with them, you know, because I hope he does a good job. I just look at it from an experience standpoint.
Yeah.
You know, was curious to you. Go ahead.
I don't know. I don't know how you feel about whenever they're like, okay, we're going to take an established character and we're going to gender swap them. To me, that makes me feel like they don't have confidence in any female superheroes enough to develop them further and portray a strong version of that superhero. Well,
Similar to what Daniel Craig said about why would you make James Bond a woman? Just write good roles for women.
Well, it doesn't make sense. The James Bond thing is a male fantasy.
Right.
It doesn't make sense for a woman. A woman can already get whatever man she wants, really. You know?
I mean,
Bond.
You know, if it's from the comics, then okay, you know, but yeah, it's tough, man.
Like
you know?
Ana de Armas's character from No Time to Die. She was good in that film. And it's like, I feel like you could move forward with her.
I mean, she was, but I was also just figuring out her boobs stayed in that dress.
Yeah. It's like, probably one of those gadgets.
You know, how did they stay in there?
You don't know. I don't know.
Flipping around and fighting and they just stayed.
They didn't stay in that dress when she saw Keanu Reeves and knock knock. Yeah, it should have been.
So probably, you know, we'll see.
CGI'd it on.
I was also thinking before we get into the feature film, is it weird to me like when they ask actors, like I saw, I guess Edward Furlong was doing an interview, and they asked him, like, what are your thoughts on them killing John Connor in Dark Fate? But these most actors, like, you can't tell me they're answering that stuff genuinely, okay? Because, like, yeah, these are roles that are hard to play. He did 25 plus years ago, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's like, does he really give a shit from that point? You know, it's like, he played him in one movie. There's been several John Connors since. I would call the character John Connor iconic in science fiction, but not Edward Furlong in the role. He's not iconic. He's not Harrison Ford playing Han Solo, you know? So I see that a lot in these interviews, like these older actors. I'm like, what'd you think about what they did to that character? I'm like, does it matter? They got paid to do a job. They don't give a shit, you know?
Well, it's kind of like, he was the first version of that character, right? Like, that we saw a lot of. You know, I know we had like a still shot of another actor as a stand-in. And so typically I think they're counting on that, you know, grandfather of the role type of, you know, image of that actor, you know, like, you know, if they ask,
but my thing is like, what's he going to say? Oh, you know, they shouldn't have fucking killed him. I mean, you know,
that's like, if they ask Keaton, you know, what do you think about, you know, Robert Pattinson, you know, and his vehicle, you know, and they're just trying to get him to take his take on it. You know, well, my vehicle, you know, I, you know, mine was better. But Furlong, I guess I caught some of it. Like, I had a little YouTube short that came across my feed, and he was talking about how he was actually, he had a deal for like $25 million to be in Terminator 3 as John Connor. And they told him, okay, look, we know you've had some trouble with drugs. Just stay off of them, stay clean, don't get in any trouble. And, you know, you can, you know, we'll have you sign this deal. And as long as you don't get in any trouble, you know, don't do any drugs, stay clean, you can have the role of John Connor, T3. Oh, yeah, and he said that night they went in, you know, he fucking OD'd in a club with his friends. So he didn't get it.
Oh yeah. That story's been around a while.
Yeah.
You know, I just find it interesting, these reporter questions. And then, lastly, this story kind of came and disappeared very quickly yesterday. There was a report that Warner Brothers was developing The Matrix 5 with Drew Goddard directing. And all of a sudden, the report kind of disappeared, where Warner Brothers kind of quietly said, no, we're not. it's not in production, you know. Man, after Resurrections, we don't need more Matrix.
No, dude.
It was already a stretch with Revolutions and Reloaded. You know, it's like, I guess it's in the same vein as if you only have the original Star Wars movies, that was it. We probably would have, for the most part, been satisfied, didn't need any more. Mm-hmm. Then we got the prequels and then the sequels and whatever else comes next. And I feel like that with the Matrix too. Like, you know, we have the trilogy, let's be satisfied. We don't need more. And maybe 20 years from now, okay, maybe revisit it with a new actor playing Neo or something like that. But it's like, it's almost like you're just trying to cash in on something that doesn't need to be cashed in on.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the Star Wars prequels and the sequels work a little bit better, because they're 20 years apart. The Matrix just feels like, this point, Warner Bros. Is trying to force it out there. And do they really need it now? They've got the success of Dune. You know, the success of the Godzilla Kong franchises. I imagine I can't help but think they're not going to try to build a franchise off of Wonka. You know, I think it's just a matter of time for that sequel is announced. Like, Warner Brothers doesn't need to revisit The Matrix to be successful. You know,
they've got, like you said, the third book of Dune. And then what if they wanted to do Children of Dune again and make a new TV series? And do a time jump and explore Children of Dune. It's like, I think they could do it, and it could be, you know, good success for them. But yeah, like,
leave the Matrix in the vault. You know,
they didn't even have Neo doing martial arts. He was using like telekinesis or whatever.
Resurrections was weird, and all the meta stuff in it was just, it was too much.
Yeah.
Right now, leave that alone. Anyways, that's some news to cover. All right, well, let's get today's featured film for Monsters, 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 or Monster Mania Month, whatever we decide we're going to call it, because we can call it what the fuck we want.
Yeah.
This week, we're doing a modern movie masterpiece, monster movie, and that is who I think is the current king of monster films, especially his designs and the things he comes up with, his concept art, and that is
definitely
the great Guillermo del Toro. And this is his Oscar-winning film from 2014 or 15. I can't remember exactly off the top of my head. It's not a real old movie.
No.
And that is The Shape of Water. And now I got to know what year it is. Let me look real quick.
2017.
Okay, yeah. It wasn't too old. So this movie, essentially, takes place in the 1960s. And it's one of those organic worlds that I love, that Del Toro lets it exist. You feel like it's the 1960s, but you feel like there's something real scientific modern about it, because you have this young lady who lives next door to a man who they never say whether it's her brother or some of you, or just really good friends. You know, he looks after her. She's a mute, so she speaks with sign language, and he's a closeted, you know, gay man who's trying to get his life going again with his career. And they almost hint at that maybe he lost his job because of being, you know,
that's what it looks like.
Yeah. And he's played by Richard Jenkins, who's remarkable. I mean, you know, in the film. And so is Sally Hawkins. I mean, Guillermo del Toro wrote this movie for her. He even said, if she didn't say yes, I don't know if I would have done the movie. So Sally is a janitor who works in a research facility. We don't know what kind. We assume it's kind of military-ish. What's the black actress's name?
Oh,
damn it. Octavia Spencer.
Yeah, Octavia Spencer.
And she's her friend, and they work together, and she chats all day to her, and she does the talking for her, and they bring in a new project in the facility. And Michael Shannon plays the very evil Dr. Strickland, who is looking after this monster, and he wants to turn over the military because we find out this monster's secrets so we can win the space race before the Russians.
Yeah.
And it turns out there's also Russian double agents that are inside the facility trying to get the monster as well. But the Russian double agent finds out that his Russian leaders really just want the monster dead too, instead of it falling into the fan in the U.S. hands. So they instruct him to kill the monster. But Miss Esposito, Sally's character, ends up befriending this creature, and you can almost say falling in love with him.
Yeah.
Which is alluded at, and which I think Del Toro does a great job not pushing that to make it weird. It's simply alluded to. I think it could have been really weird to make it too strange, you know.
I mean, her telling Octavia Spencer's character that his pelvis opens up and a penis comes out, and that's how they had sex is kind of weird.
That's about as far as it goes.
Yeah. You don't see it. That would be
right.
That would be weird.
And so, you know, and she decides when she gets word that they're going to kill it, that she wants to rescue it and set it free. And ultimately she does, before the creature has a showdown with Strickland, and Strickland gets what he deserves. And first off, Michael Shannon in this movie, this dude fucks, man. I mean, that's just, he's a mean dude.
Yeah,
he's not a nice guy. He's racist. But he pretends he's religious. He's homophobic, but pretends he's religious.
Mm-hmm.
He's nasty. He's disgusting. But yet you kind of like respect him as a viewer because he's so evil.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
He's truly a great villain.
And he's got a cattle prod.
Yeah. And he goes home and acts like this perfect dad to his wife and his kids, not knowing what he does behind the scenes, that he's a complete and utter asshole. Mm-hmm. You know, and then when he gets what coming to him as an audience member, you find yourself cheering. You know, and on the flip side of that is you have Miss Esposito's character, who's very innocent, very just trying to live her. She's living a normal life. She goes to work. She comes home. She masturbates. She eats. She goes to bed. She chats with
Richard Jenkins.
she chats with Richard Jenkins next door, and they go have pie together. They hang out together, watch movies. He seems very obsessed with modern television, the 1960s and all that. But he doesn't like violence. Like, he gets upset if he sees violence on TV, and that's why he's kind of against her rescuing this creature and all this. He seems to be a very, this is a civil rights. It's a civil rights heiress. So he's very, calm and doesn't want, he just wants to live his life and try to get his career going. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of opposite to each other, but yet they are the type of opposites that attract. That's why they're such good friends. And she ends up talking him to helping her rescue the monster. And the monster is played by Doug Jones, who appears in a lot of Del Toro's films. And his performance to his costume is extraordinary, as well as he always does. I mean,
always.
He brings out the emotion. Focus. Yeah. He brings out the emotion in the creature. The suit is really well designed. And you feel sympathy for this creature as you watch the film. There's a lot of allegory in this movie. I just mentioned it's during the civil rights movement, about right and wrong, and people coming to terms with people of color having jobs. People of homosexual orientation coming out into the world in the free love era of the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And the creature is an allegory to all of that, wanting his rights as this living, beautiful living thing that doesn't deserve what's happened to him.
And also, women being the heroes, and mm-hmm. all the men in this film being either cowards or jerks.
Yeah.
Think about it. The pie mm-hmm. shop owner, jerk, the neighbor, Jenkins character, bit of a coward. Strickland, mm-hmm. jerk, the general, jerk, the scientist who's a double agent, kind of a coward.
Yeah.
Kind of takes it. Mm-hmm. He's maybe borderline, probably the only one you could say, well,
he does the right thing. Well, he does the right thing in the end.
He does the right thing. Yeah. He's in a situation where he really can't be courageous, or else, he's just going to get shut down anyways. That five-star general wasn't going to take any shit. But the women are the heroes, and even the men that are like Octavia Spencer's character was yelling at some of the other male janitors, and they're like, yes, ma'am. but I thought that was a funny thing. So it brings to light other things, things coming of age in that time, gaining civil rights, and then, equality and all of that. Nice theme and then the monster, of course, and his egg eating, finger eating too. He eats fingers. Apparently. Well, no, he didn't eat them. He spit them out. Yeah. And that was Michael Shannon's character. He's like, don't know if the sutures will take. And he's bending his wife over, and he's like bleeding all over his wife. And she's like, honey, you're bleeding. He's like, stop talking.
He's just going at it. Yeah.
That conversation he has with Sally Hawkins' character in his office, he's like, do you squawk when you make noise?
He's a mean dude.
Dude, he's fucking creepy. He does it so well, but he is a nice guy, right? He's one of the nicest guys. That's like Bradley Cooper. He played some really good jerks in some of his films, like Wedding Crashers. He was a big jerk in that film. He was an asshole, but he's actually really, really nice in real life. It's funny how the actors can show that range and be so different from their own personality. It's just a test to why this film was one nominated for so many Oscars. And, of course, it won two of the four that it was nominated for. I think the other two were actresses. Yeah. Best Picture, Best Director. Sally Hawkins was a nominee for Best Actress.
It won four Oscars. It won Best Achievement in Directing, Best Motion Picture, Best Achievement in Music, and Best Achievement in Production Design.
There we go. I was surprised to see that it only just made back its money. But I think it's because, he couldn't call it Creature from the Black Lagoon. As you told me before, this was originally going to be a Universal monster film, or meant to be.
Well, he was definitely inspired by it. In fact, there's a nod to the Creature of Black Lagoon with when Strickland says, "We dug this thing out of the Amazon."
Yep. You know? And then the trying to stop the bows and arrows, or trying to stop the drill with bows and arrows. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, alerts you to the natives that were worshiping it. And he even says in the Amazon where that they were worshiping him. So it's, you know, definitely, you know, it's a monster movie. It's a monster, universal monster film without being a universal monster.
It can almost be a sequel to Creature in Black Lagoon.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, easily. And, you know, we all know Del Toro's super inspired by those films and monsters, and it's his favorite thing in the world. And, you know, and this film was one of his most personal movies, he said, he made. And he even said, if the film wasn't well received, he might have considered quitting directing because that's how personal it was to him. But obviously, the film ended up being a big success, winning a lot of awards and box office numbers aside. You know, I think it found its place with Blu-ray sales, I'm sure, and home video, and
yeah,
has done well since.
Oh yeah, it's done. I mean, if you're at least, you know, breaking even on an artsy film, or a deeper meaning film, you know, $195 million at that time, that's a lot of money to recoup.
Yeah.
So it's, I'm pretty sure a lot of it, obviously costume, but I'm sure the actors weren't cheap.
Well, I remember this movie had legs too. I remember it came out and, like you said, it was playing only so many theaters, and every week it was like in the top five of the box office. So it didn't make ton of money right away, but it slowly made money as people want to see it, and it was open up in more theaters.
Yeah, it's safe to call it a success. It's obviously a success. Yeah. But I was just, you know, I was like, wow, why didn't I see it make more in the theaters? But I wonder what it came up against. I wonder if the theaters were crowded with the, you know, something else. Was Infinity? I don't know if Infinity War came out around that time.
No, the official release date for this was, dun-dun-dun-dun. It came out in December. It premiered at the International Film Festival in August. Then was released at some film festivals, and its big release was its wide release was December in the U.S.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Christmas time, you know.
Star Wars episode, Last Jedi came out around that time, but okay, I don't know if it came out. Yeah.
Yeah, that was probably it.
Jumanji, Pitch Perfect 3.
You know, so there were some big movies. So this
Thor was Ragnarok. Yeah.
So it was an art house film that probably found an audience, you know. Slowly
it was a top 17 that month.
Yeah.
It did beat out, what did it beat out? It beat out Bad Moms. I think that was the one with J.J. Watt in it.
I don't think that's saying much.
No, it's not. Yeah, but I was, yeah.
But
it beat out Blade Runner 2049. There we go.
It is a masterpiece from Guillermo del Toro. I don't think it's not my favorite My favorite Guillermo del Toro film is Pan's Labyrinth.
Definitely.
Which is another movie with a great villain. I mean, the general in that movie. It's funny because Guillermo del Toro is known for his monsters, but most of his great villains in his movies are humans. You know,
makes you think the real monsters are the
real monsters. But it got us thinking to do a top five this week. And we came up with our top five monster creatures in Guillermo del Toro's films. And I'll kick it off. And at number five, I have the Amphibian Man from this movie. Maybe it's not the scariest design. Maybe it's not the creepiest, but I think it's the emotion that the creature shows that makes you sympathize with it, that makes you happy as hell when he kills Strickland at the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's literally one of those movies where you want to cheer the screen. You're like, yeah, get that motherfucker. He got what he deserved. and you feel a sense of freedom when he jumps into the ocean and goes away back to his life. Because, again, the allegory for this film is that's what it's about. Accepting people, whether they're humans, whether they're creatures, for who they are, and letting them have their life.
Yeah. I've got I can't honorable mention. I don't want to do that, but I definitely wanted to work him in here, and I don't have him on this list because I went with like scary. And so I've got Samael from Hellboy 2004. the dog creature with all the tentacles on it and splits into two. That was a pretty freaky looking animal. And they're hard to kill, especially for humans.
I mean, that's fair enough. Cause I mean, at four, I actually have Hellboy. I think that, what Guillermo del Toro did to bring Hellboy to the screen and make it believable using prosthetics, Ron Perlman, I think it's pretty remarkable because if you buy into it, they could have easily CGI'd it and done it like that. But I think it makes him so much better looking real because you feel like Hellboy's there on screen and interacting with everybody. And Perlman does a good job of it, doesn't feel fake. And one thing I love about Del Toro is he used a lot of practical effects.
Yeah.
That's
one thing he does good.
Yeah. As almost every character on my list is practical effects. I know he had to use some CGI with Samael and a few characters.
Yeah.
But on my list, I didn't realize that all of them are practical effects.
Wow. Yeah. You definitely beat me on that one. I didn't put Hellboy on there because I felt like he was only scary in one point, and that was at the end of Hellboy 2004. So I've got.
Yeah, that shit. That movie sucked.
Yeah,
the reboot's not that old. 2004.
No. The first Hellboy 2000, not Hellboy.
Oh,
2.
Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah, where he becomes a demon.
And I'm just referring to it as 2004 to separate it from the new one. I have the Reapers from Blade 2. Their mouths open up with those friggin' mandibles, and you could see like friggin' the guts of their mouth open. I thought that's pretty freaky. It reminds me of Alien, kind of whenever the queen opens her mouth and got all those extra mouths.
Yeah, no, they were definitely creepy.
Yeah.
And I was going to look up something.
That's what I got it for. I have to forget if Blade 2 is the one with Ryan Reynolds or not.
The reason I did not, I think the Reapers are cool, but the reason I almost have it 5 on my list of Amphibian Man, but here's why I didn't. Because the Reapers, Blade 2 is Del Toro and he directed it, but he didn't create a lot of that stuff. It was one of the few movies he directed that he didn't create. I'm sure he had a say in the concept art and the design and all that, but it didn't come from his mind.
Gotcha.
That's
fair.
Because someone else wrote the film.
Yeah.
At number 3, I have the Fawn from Pan's Labyrinth. Not exactly the scariest creature, but a believable living creature on screen that's used as a mix of practical effects. And I don't think they CGI'd the legs. I think they used an actor on stilts and they made it look like he was walking.
Yeah.
And as he goes on the journey with Othello, is that the little girl's name? Othello?
Ophelia.
Ophelia. Throughout the movie. And he's her guide and you don't know if he's good or bad the whole time. And he has he does have a little bit of evil in him, but ultimately he's doing it because he realizes it's part of the prophecy for her to become the princess she's supposed to be. And just a cool fucking design,
He's definitely unique. And I have him in the same spot. I have him as my number 3. And for that same reason, I mean, he's very unique. Whenever he scolds her, you're like, man, that's kind of a bad, guy's kind of a jerk, and she made a mistake, but, ultimately he's good and he shows it in the end for sure.
Oh, man, I wouldn't be surprised if our 2 and 1 are almost the same. And my number 2, and man, my biggest beef with this character is I needed more. And that's the Angel of Death from Hellboy 2. He's only on screen so briefly and he's so fucking cool. And Del Toro's even talked about that. Yeah, I mean, we designed this badass fucking creature, and then we have on screen for like 5 minutes. It's scary. He's fucking just evil, but he's not there very long in Hellboy 2, and that's the only disappointing part to it. And so I feel like there would be this whole large background story to this Angel of Death, and like you could almost do a whole movie of this motherfucker just fucking shit up,
Yeah, man, I almost forgot about him. So I don't have him on there, but he probably should be in my top 5. Probably better than Samael, but I have Knifehead from Pacific Rim. Kaiju, big one that they were trying to take down, kill the brother. I thought that was probably the coolest one.
It is cool. I like Pacific Rim because it's such a great popcorn flick, but like I didn't feel the monsters were anything like super blew me away. It was more about the spectacle of the film.
Yeah. Maybe that's what I got mixed up in, the spectacle.
Yeah. But no, it's a cool creature. Yeah. But my number one, I mean, it's as easy as the Pale Man.
Easy.
From Pan's Labyrinth. I mean,
same.
Scariest creatures I've ever seen on screen, man.
He is fucking freaky, man.
When she's running to get away from him, and you're just like, you're this one of those scenes in a film where you're literally, they say you're on the edge of your seat, you're pulling yourself to the edge of your seat. You're like, run, Athelia, run.
Yes.
You know, his eyes in his hands and the way he's walking, it's just like, it is fucked up, man.
And eating the fairies, the way he eats them. Oh my God.
And that came out of like Guillermo del Toro's mind. You're like, what is wrong with this guy?
Yeah, for real. It's what's crazy is, and we talked about this in an earlier episode, when we did Seven. He turned down Seven because he thought it was too disturbing for him. I'm like, how is anything too disturbing for you?
This eyeball creature.
Dude, the dude could probably direct Hellraiser, you know, really good.
Well, I guess there's a difference in psychological terror and monster terror. Because monster terror, you can accept that it's not real. They're made up, you know. Yes, monsters are, there are human monsters, but real monsters aren't real.
Yeah.
So I guess psychological terror is that human monster aspect that can be a little more scary to people.
Yeah.
So I guess that's fair. So your was Pale Man also
number one? Yes, Pale Man. I mean, you can't have anything else up there other than Pale Man. I feel like that's his, you know, crown jewel. I guess you'd say.
And such an incredible character and an incredible movie too, man. I mean, Pan's Labyrinth is in probably my top 20 movies of all time. I mean, that's how great I think it is. You know, I know when we did the episode, Long didn't agree with me on that. He's like, oh, it's okay. I'm like, and it still bothered me. Like, how can you say this movie's okay? I mean, it's a brilliant, brilliant film. My mom loved it. If that tells you anything, because I took her to see it. We saw it theater together, me and my mom. And my mom was like, wasn't sure what I was getting her into, but she ended up loving the film, you know, and my mom usually doesn't like weird, you know, but she thought that was a really well done film. So, you know,
I would expect, I could reason with someone saying, man, it's really good, but I have to put it behind this stuff because it's not really my type of movie that I like to see. Or it's not my favorite genre, you know, or I'm not a huge fan of fantasy, but I respect the costume design and all of this. That's something you could, you know, okay, I can see, you know, your reasoning, but it's like to say it's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Dude.
Yeah. It's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
I think just as The Shape of Water is, and Guillermo del Toro is quite a brilliant director. And I'm really looking forward to his Frankenstein film that's coming out later this year. I mean, the two movies I didn't care for Crimson Peak all that much, just because I think it's bogged down in the love story too much.
Yeah.
It's a little slow. And then I can't get through Nightmare Alley, man. I've tried to watch it. I don't know what it is. I guess I'm going to have to sit down one day and get the right frame of mind and say, look, I need to finish Nightmare Alley.
Some people say that's like one of his best films.
No, it starts out so slow. I've had trouble getting into it. And I just need to like really be awake and focused one day and sit back and watch it. All right. Well, next week, man, we move ahead in our Monster Mania month, or Monsters, 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 as we're going to go back to the 1950s again, as we did last week with Godzilla. And we are going to do a film that inspired Godzilla a bit, inspired Ray Harryhausen for sure, as far as special effects go and things like that. Mm-hmm. And this movie is an all-time classic, which was at the time, man, this movie is what people had for special effects, and it blew audience members away with the stop motion. And that is The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
I say there are things better left unsolved.
Who knows what waits for us in nature's no man's land?
Impossible. impossible, unbelievable, fantastic. But I tell you, it could happen. It could happen. It could happen. It could happen.
Yes, it could happen. For various authorities believe that buried somewhere under the polar ice cap, in a state of suspended animation, are the awesome creatures, the leviathans that roamed the earth at the dawn of time. And under certain conditions, a nuclear explosion could free one from his icy tomb. Then, guided by instinct, the beast would come back, back to the caverns of the deepest Atlantic where it was spawned. An armored giant, wreaking his prehistoric fury on modern man and his puny machines. Cities would be terrorized by the cruel intruder from the past. Populations crazed and panicked with fear by its destructive force. Granite and steel would crumble. Soldiers and their weapons would be powerless before the onslaught of the beast. The beast. The beast. The beast from 20,000 fathoms.
Herald Square, 34th Street, Broadway. Every section of the city is guarded. No one knows where the monster will strike next.
Another one, Colonel?
No.
You know what a radioactive isotope is?
No, but if it can be loaded, I can fire it.
I'll load it. Just remember one thing. This is the only isotope of its kind this side of Oak Ridge, so you can't miss.
This is a cool movie, man. It's one of those movies we talked about before. It's got that charm to it, that aesthetic that you just sit back and you just, if you truly appreciate film, you just sit back and you smile and you enjoy it, you know?
Yeah. No, that you definitely.
You don't overthink it. You just think like, wow, someone put their work and their magic into this in the 1950s and made this film.
And without the use of
without the use of computers, without the use of fancy editing and special effects. And I love those kind of old movies that just have it right there on screen in front of you. And it's genuinely an exciting, fun, good film from that era. So we're going to talk that next week on the show. And we're going to also have this week in pop culture, or this month in pop culture history, will be next week as well. So a lot to look forward to on the show next week. And we thank you as always for listening. And remember us at the rebelradiopodcast.com for all your Rebel Radio needs. As we trek on to 410 years and Comicpalooza 2024 coming up soon. That's all we got today. Thank you for listening. This has been Mark.
This has been Matt.
Remember, as always, just go there
and do it.